So something I've learned over the years, sorry for those of you who have toddlers, but toddlers don't really care. They don't really care, most of the time, about what people think of them. They don't care, I found from experience, of if everyone's watching them while they have a meltdown. They don't care about that. It doesn't bother them. They just go ahead and do it, no matter where it is. They don't care who they embarrass. When they throw themselves down on the floor, kicking and screaming, in the middle of a grocery store, they don't care about that. They just do it. Because for the most part, in those moments, they're not really thinking about their parents or how people view them. They're just thinking about the terrible thing that just happened to them at the checkout line when they couldn't buy that toy or whatever it might be, right? They're very focused on that area. So toddlers, in a lot of ways, don't care. Now, I have some stories that I won't share, and maybe you have if you're a parent, of being with a toddler in those moments that were deeply embarrassing when they did one of those things. But I don't think it matches this one. This is a true story. 2-year-old Claudia wasn't happy on this particular day. In fact, when the day began, she had a plan. She usually, when she was around home, she liked to wear this blanket, or sheet actually. It was just a sheet, but it had dinosaurs on it, so that made it awesome. And so as a 2-year-old, she loved to just wrap herself in this sheet with dinosaurs on it, and she would, if she had her way, she would go everywhere with that sheet on her shoulders, right? It was just her favorite thing in the world. And one particular day, her mother really wanted her to put on a dress. Because they were going to a big party and there'd be a lot of important people there, and she wanted her to wear this nice flowery dress, and she wouldn't let her wear her dinosaur sheet to the party. The nerve. And so Claudia was angry the whole morning and the whole afternoon, and when it came to the evening, they put her in her dress, kicking and screaming, hauled her out to the car, buckled her into her seat, drove off to the party, and she was still mad. In fact, she was getting madder and madder as they went along. And finally, they got to the place. It's a huge, big, white building. In fact, it's called the White House. And they got to the place where this event was being held with her parents and a bunch of other dignitaries, and went to the big room in this building. I guess annually there's a Passover Seder that's celebrated at the White House or other places, and very important people get invited to this. So Claudia's family, and Claudia included, and her sister were invited to this Passover Seder. And so they're all gathered in this room, all these dignitaries and Claudia, and she was still mad. And the door opened, and there was the moment when the President Obama and Michelle walk into the room, and the room gets silent except Claudia. And all of a sudden, and the White House photographer came in at the same time, so he captured it on film, took the picture of Claudia throwing herself at the feet of the President of the United States. So there she is, laying face down in front of the President and the First Lady. Now, she didn't care. She really did not care who it was that she had thrown herself at the feet of, or what anybody else was thinking about this situation. She just absolutely did not care. And so, over the course of the weekend, Claudia's tantrum was featured in The Salon, a magazine called Salon, The Daily Mail, The Huffington Post, on CNN, on The Washington Post, Yahoo Parenting, The Telegraph, The New York Daily News, Time Magazine. She was written about in Macedonia, China, Taiwan, Argentina, New Zealand, Peru, all over the world. Everyone knew about Claudia's tantrum in front of the President of the United States. But she still did not care. There wasn't one moment in that whole time where the thought crossed her mind as she was spread-eagled on the floor in front of the President to say, you know, I probably shouldn't be doing this. You know, this is actually causing a lot of embarrassment for my mom and dad. And this is a very important occasion which they've been looking forward to for the whole year, and I'm ruining it for them. Not for one moment did she think that. And she didn't think, well, maybe if I just get myself up and I could pretend that I tripped and I fell. It was an accident. But she didn't think about that at all. Because you and I were once toddlers. And all of us, all of us are wired in a way to focus on ourselves from birth. We're self-centered. And so these next few weeks, we're talking about some shifts at the very core of us. We're not talking about external things that you add on to your life, behaviors that you just say, I'm going to try to do this to make me different. We're talking about inner changes that need to happen, changes of the heart of who we are, ultimately so that we can have the perspective of Jesus. One of the scriptures talks about the fact that we have the mind of Christ. And so last week, we talked about how the reality is, even in the lives of the disciples as we read the Gospels, that they didn't always have the mind of Christ. They didn't always think about things the way Jesus thinks about things. They didn't always look at the world the way Jesus looks at the world. In fact, sometimes their minds were on very different things. And sometimes our minds are on very different things, too. So it's going to need more than just external changes for us to begin to think more like Jesus, if we're going to have the same mind of Jesus. So here's the first one that we're going to talk about, the first soul shift. It's a shift in orientation from me to you. So this is a definition, if you could have that up on the screen. A shift in orientation from focusing on ourselves to focusing on others. Easy to put it on a slide, right? A shift in focus from focusing on ourselves to focusing on others. A lot harder to do. It's not an easy shift to make. You and I struggle with that. It doesn't come naturally to us. And sometimes we're a lot more like Claudia than we are like Christ, right? We may not throw ourselves down on the carpet, but we're still having a little bit of a meltdown. Martin Luther said, the reformer said many years ago, the heart is curved inward upon itself. The heart is curved inward upon itself. This is what he wrote. Our nature, by the corruption of the first sin, being so deeply curved in on itself that it not only bends the best gifts of God towards itself and enjoys them, or rather even uses God himself in order to attain these gifts, but it also fails to realize that it so wickedly, curvedly, and viciously seeks all things, even God, for its own sake. So there's a story in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, and verses 30 to 37. And it's the story of Jesus and his disciples, his followers, going along the road. They've gone from Galilee, and they're heading to Jerusalem. And so we know, because Jesus tells them and us, why they're going to Jerusalem. He's going there to die. And they're having this conversation. And so Jesus says, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed, but 3 days later, he will rise from the dead. Now, the ironic thing about that is, as he's explaining all of this, it wasn't the first time that he explained it, as he's explaining this, the disciples are also having a conversation amongst themselves along the road. And the topic of that conversation is, who would be greater among them? So they're having this little debate about who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God. So they're anticipating Jesus going to Jerusalem, setting up his kingdom, and picking his right-hand men, right? And so they're debating that, and I'm sure they're not arguing for each other, right? Like, Peter, I think you should be the guy at the right hand of Jesus when he comes in his kingdom. And then Peter says, no, I think it should be you, John. You know, you were so close to Jesus. You should be his right-hand man. I think, knowing human nature, they were all arguing for themselves, saying, you know, I've got the qualities that it takes to be at the right hand of Jesus, you know, in that place of power and authority. And so they're having this little discussion. Now, we don't know exactly what they were saying, but Jesus is aware of this going on. And so he confronts them and he says, what were you discussing as we were walking along on the road? But, you know, I imagine them kind of putting their heads down and mumbling because they felt a little ashamed, because they were talking about who was the greatest or going to be the greatest in Jesus' kingdom. It says they were arguing about it. And so this is very ironic. To me, it is, to me at least. It's the fact that they're following someone like Jesus while at the same time having a mind that was very contrary to the character of Christ. They're fighting or arguing among themselves about who is the best and who would have that place of power. Now, of course, we never do things like that, right? We never sort of argue with God and his purposes and his plans and say, you know, I think I have a better idea. We do it all the time, I think. And so at the same time that Jesus is talking about his betrayal and his death, they're arguing amongst themselves. So I think it's possible for us, even though we're following Jesus, the one who scriptures say in Philippians 2, that though he was God, did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave, even to the point of dying a criminal's death on the cross. So even though this is the Jesus that we follow, we tend to cling to our personal rights and privileges. And even when following someone who on the cross cried out to the Father and he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, willing to forgive the very enemies who put him on that cross, we find it often hard to forgive even the smallest offenses, even though we know, even ourselves, we find it hard to forgive ourselves, even though we know that God has forgiven. Because we've inherited a kind of me-first virus. We were born with that, and we continue often to pursue that, putting ourselves in front of others. So Jesus takes those disciples, and he sits down with them, and he gives them another lesson. And he says, whoever wants to be first must take the last place and be servant of everyone else. He's beginning to teach them again what it means to have the mind of Christ, what it means to be disciples in his kingdom. The way that you're arguing, the things that you're arguing about are not the ways that it works in my kingdom. You haven't yet completely moved, made this shift in your heart from me to you. And so I'm going to show you what it means to do that. And so in Mark chapter 10, verses 43 to 45, he says, you know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be the slave of everyone else. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. So here is this vision that Jesus has for their lives and for ours as well. He says, among you it will be different. You know, this is the way it works in the world. When you get put in a position of authority, however small or large, you feel like you have the power and control to lord it over those under you. He's saying in the kingdom, as followers of Jesus, things are not like that. Among you, it's not to be like that. You're to be a servant, and here is why. It's because this is who I am, the Son of Man. I lay down my life as a ransom for many. But the disciples at that point, you know, they're still not wired like Jesus. They still think very much differently. And so it is possible to be on that same road with Jesus, but to think so differently than he does. For them and for us, we haven't yet shifted from me to you. There's a story of the founder of the Salvation Army. His name is William Booth. And toward the end of his life, he was becoming quite ill, very weak. And there was a large conference where all of the Salvation Army people gathered in a conference room, and he was to be the keynote speaker for that meeting. But came to the day of the meeting, and he was too ill to attend. So we asked whether he could actually submit his speech on paper and have someone read it to the people gathered there. So they all gathered in that room, and they sat down, and they were waiting in expectation to hear the words of the great man. And the time came, and the MC of the meeting stood up and he said, William Booth is too ill to be here, but he sent his message along with us, so I'd like to read it. So he took out the piece of paper, and on that piece of paper was only one word, and the word was others. And he chose that word because it summed up the mission of that movement, which was for others. And really, if you want to sum up this shift from me to you, that word is very appropriate, the word others. Because Jesus, oftentimes, is very different from us. His whole life was geared and oriented toward others. And so sometimes, in order to kind of get a gauge, it's hard to gauge where our souls are at and what's going on in them. We need to ask some questions like this. If your closest friends or spouse were asked, what would they say about your willingness to care for others. What evidence is there that God is making you more aware of the needs of the people around you? You might want to ask yourself, how do I treat those I live with, work with, my neighbors, my friends, my relatives? What about the people that I find it hard to like? And so oftentimes, those relationships that we have, those closest to us, become mirrors for our soul. They show really how spiritual we really are. The commands of God, the greatest command, to love the Lord your God with all your soul, strength, soul and mind and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself, you know, that command to love God with everything that we are is hard for us to measure. You know, how do I measure if I really do love God? I think one of the clearest ways is we look at our relationships with others. And so there was that, we read this last week and this morning as well, from 1 John chapter 4. Very uncomfortable verse, which I really didn't like the very first time I heard this one read. The first part's great, because it starts out, we love God, we love because He first loved us. So that's the good part. But then he goes on and he says, whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. That's the part that makes me feel uncomfortable sometimes. Not that I can't say, you know, I really hate that person, but I certainly don't love them. And so it just kind of gets under my skin, statements like that. Your love for God is no greater than your love for other people. So I think the issue with this sometimes is we could really get anxious about this, because as we look at our relationships, we realize that we really don't love people the way that we should love them, and we don't love God the way that we should love them or want to love Him. And so we find that there's still some room, there's still some growth, there's still some journeying in this shift from me to you that needs to happen in my life. So here's what I'm not saying when I'm saying these things. I'm not saying that you need to act as if you love God with your whole being and act as if you love your neighbor as yourself. Because if you're trying to do that without the love of God indwelling you, it's going to be a burden rather than a joy. It's going to be, we're going to talk a little bit about in a couple of weeks about moving from slave to child. It's going to be like one of those situations where you say, oh yeah, I guess God says I have to love that person, so I'll try really hard to love them. And it doesn't work that well. It's frustrating, it creates anger, and it's hopeless, really. Henry Nouwen wrote that Nouwen could give unreservedly of himself because he had a full self to give, a self anchored upon his true spiritual identity as God's beloved. Now, I've heard people say quite often that if you want to love others, if you're going to be able to love others, you have to love yourself first. Now, I can see where they're going with that statement, but I think oftentimes that philosophy becomes another way, another excuse for us to focus in again. Because we say, well, I can't love you because I really don't love myself enough yet, so I'm going to work on loving myself, and then maybe someday I'll be able to love you. And it becomes more of this turning inward on ourselves again. I think the problem is not there. I don't think that's the solution. I think we need to say you can't truly love others if you don't see yourself as beloved of the Father. So if you don't see yourself as loved by God deeply, as the beloved son or daughter of God, it's really hard for you to love other people, and yourself included. Because this recognizes that it's His love that comes first, and it's His love that frees us to love others selflessly, to move from me to you, because we love because He first loved us. So I want to, this is really a journey, right? It's a journey that we're going on. And I want to talk to you about some of the stages in that journey, and it actually fits in with what we've talked about in the past, about our journey to wholeness in Christ, and that it doesn't happen overnight, and we're on this journey to wholeness in Him. And the fourth milepost of that journey is that we become Christ-centered, others-oriented disciples. That's sort of where God is taking us. So I want to talk to you about those four stages that we need to do to help us to move from me to you. And the first one is that we need to wake up. We need to wake up to the fact that many times, for most of us, my life revolves around me. I think about me a lot. I pray about me a lot. I don't always think about you. I don't always listen to you when you're telling me things. I'm thinking about others. You know, other thoughts are going on. I'm sure it happens to you too. But you know, there's other thoughts going on in our minds, right? At the same time as you're trying to listen to some. So we're often turned to ourselves. Think about it when you see a group photo, and you're in it. Who do you look at first? You look at yourself, don't you? There's probably some real selfless person that looks at everybody else and then themselves. But you often look at yourself. You know, how good am I looking or how bad am I looking? You know, is that okay what I'm wearing? Does it make me look fat or too skinny or whatever it is? You look at yourself first because we're kind of wired that way. And so wake up to that fact that you often put yourself first. I think one of the great things about marriage is when you're first married, you find out how selfish you are. Well, hopefully. You know, the longer you're married, you still are recognizing some ways that you're more self-centered than you should be. And so marriage can have that really good effect in your life of helping you to recognize that you need to put the other person first. Having kids can do that in your life too, because your focus shifts onto them so much. And so you have to sacrifice many times, and you have to think about them often before you think about yourself. And so parenting and marriage can be a great thing that God uses in our lives to make us more like Him if we cooperate with that. But we need to recognize those ways that we think about me first and call that out in our lives, to wake up to it. The second stage is just to begin to take an interest in others. One thing may be that rather than just always being interested and wanting to be involved in the lives of people that will give something back to us, in friendship or whatever way that they give back to us, find someone who can give nothing back to you and invest in their life. Someone who you look at them and say, what could they have to benefit me? And you say, your answer is nothing. But you invest in their lives and you're going to love them and take an interest in them. And actually in the process, you probably find out that they have a lot to give to you and you'll benefit a great deal. So begin to think about what is it like for them to be them, to listen, to really listen to who they are and not just find out information, but find out what's going on in their lives. The stage three is to become a servant, to allow God to lead you and to let Him determine the outcome and in large and in small ways to serve others, to let go of the need to be in charge and to control everything. And when we do that, we make ourselves vulnerable, don't we? And that's why we sometimes don't want to. And then the fourth stage is to carry each other's burdens. An old story about missionary Dr. David Livingston. Back in the late 1800s, toward the end of his life, very ill, and the doctor sat him down, and he was planning on going back to Africa. And the doctor said to him, if you go back to Africa, you'll die. And David Livingston responded, if I don't go back to Africa, thousands will die. So he had kind of learned there had been a shift that had happened in his life, moving from me to you. So putting others' needs in front of his own. So I want you to imagine for just a moment as I close, what difference it would make if we became more oriented to others than to ourselves. What difference it would make in your marriage or in your future marriage. What difference it would make with your parents or with your children. What difference it would make in the relationships with the people that you work with, that you live with your neighbors, with your relatives. What difference would it make in the life of us as a congregation if God was working in our hearts to shift our orientation from me to you? It's not easy to do, but it's something that God wants to do in our lives. It's something that God desires to do. So let's let Him do that. I want to just lead you in a time of prayer. There'll be a prayer up on the screen in a moment. And just a suggestion, but just take a time of quiet prayer, just silent prayer where you are, and ask God to work in your heart. So here's the prayer. Father, forgive me for my self-centeredness. Help me to be oriented more toward others and less toward myself. And by your Spirit, help me to love them as you have loved me. So let's pray together.